it's my turn, so I would like to start. First of all, I would like to thank you, Lydia, and all the organizers that I'm here. The second thing I would like to say is I know that 50% of you are already very tired with the meeting. 40% are probably ill or sick or have other fevers. And to paraphrase the guy from the Pant Institute, the 10% left probably will soon suffer from one or another. So I would like to be quite short with my presentation, and it will be probably quite easy comparing to the previous one. I would like to talk about the social behavior in Saccharomyces cerevisiae population. So a short introduction. I know it's been probably mentioned in some others' talks, but still, if we think about social behaviors, we usually think about organisms like ants, bees, apes, and of course humans. But today I would like to convince you that we should not rule out yeast. And as the definition should come first, I would like to define what I mean by social. So social refers to the living organisms which do interact with other organisms, and what's very important, that they live as a collective coexistence. What also Patrick Bateson underlined that we should not personalize it. So social is irrespective of the awareness and also of the, is it voluntary or involuntary involvement. What I mean by behavior, it means that it's made by organisms, systems, but even artificial entities. And it's always in conjugation with the environment they live, and it's a response to different stimuli or inputs. This slide you also already seen at the classification of social behavior in respect to costs and benefits to the actor and recipient. So today, I would like to first talk a little bit about yeast. Then I will tell you about four short stories as an example of certain behaviors. So if you are very tired, you can skip one or another story. I also would like to say that what I mean that cooperation for me is the this kind of behavior while there is a positive effect on recipient. So it could be both. It could be both positive and negative effect of the actor. So it could be both a mutual benefit or the altruism. And the costs or benefits are defined in the term of the total lifetime reproductive success of biological entity, in this case, the yeast cell. So what we know about the yeast? Yeast, of course, are responsible for the fermentation process when they change molecule of glucose into ethanol and carbon dioxide. When we think yeast, we think alcoholic beverages, we think bread. But we should not forget that it's also that because of that, it's an organism which was long connected with human civilization, and it's very important. So it's also present in the different kind of art connected with human. Like all the biological presentation about certain organisms, there should be a life cycle involved. So yeast, that's a life cycle of the laboratory yeast. There's no mouse here. There's no point in that. Anyway, laboratory yeast can, as a haploid, they can, in a non-sexual life cycle, vegetative growth cycle, that can divide as budding, by budding, so they are called also budding yeast. They are present in different mating types, A and alpha, which in case of laboratory strain, it's a stable mating type, so they do divide as still being as a certain mating type. However, they can they mate after providing some pheromones. They mate and they made a diploid cell of which again can grow in a vegetative growth rate, vegetative type. Under stressful condition, especially when there is no glucose, they can undergo meiosis and sporulation, and each of the diploid cell can form an ascus, because those are the ascomycetes. They form an ascus, which inside there are four haploid cells, spores. And with the sporulation, the life cycle is closed. So, being important for the human civilization, Saccharomyces cerevisiae became a versatile model organism. It's very easy to handle, grow, and store. It's characteristic by the rapid growth, so every 2 hours you can have a duplication. It's quite small, it's about 5 micrometers. It has a highly versatile DNA transformation system, well-defined genetic system. There's a large set of markers of different types developed for it. So it was the first eukaryote which was sequenced, first which was transformed by plasmid, and it's also the goal of the precise gene knockout constructs. Gathering all those information, yeast are also important for those new developing functional genomics and systems biology. There is a collection of mutant deletions. So this is a collection where each gene is deleted, and in that place there are specific marker inserted. There is also a collection of green fluorescent fusion protein available. So you can do a lot of. You can imagine you can do a lot of experiments with it. Just finishing this part, we can say that out of 5,800 proteins coding in yeast, 85% are of known biological role, and about 17% of these genes are member of autologous gene family associated with human disease. So it's also a very important organism for medicine. So all of it. All of this knowledge, all of the tools which you can use for analysis, you can find in the Saccharomyces genome database, which is freely available for everyone, and it's a great source updating and kept by the Harvard University. So if you are interested in any aspect of genomics, you should just go to see it. Okay, so now I would like to start with this four stories, which could be an example of different social behavior needs. First is the organization into communities, so the population. This story is already has been already raised twice or three times at this meeting, so we'll come to this. So yeast cell, being a sessile cell, on the solid substrate, it can form a colony. If the cells do not express flocculins, so the adhesive proteins, like most laboratory strain, then it forms a colony which is not very tight. So most of the feral wild strains, they do express flocculins. That's why they form colonies which are very tightly together. They can also, the type of flocculins which can adhere to the surface allow them to form biofilms. And kind of, there's also present kind of invasive growth which is called filaments. In the liquid substrate, yeast can live as a planktonic population. This is kind of turbid. The population that you can see on the bottom, it's also characteristic for the laboratory strain. While expressing floculins, it can form or floors. This is a type of population which is grown on the border of the air and liquid, and flocks, which are just kind of the aggregation which very easily goes down in the liquid. Those kind of flora and flocks are very important for the brewery industry, because it's allowed for easily getting rid of the yeast from the product. And again, also in the liquid substrate, yeast can form biofilm and filaments if they have a chance to adhere on the bottom. Up till quite recently, there was not much knowledge about what's going on in the communities, how the... We knew that cell, of course, that yeast make colonies, but how they do it and why they do it, it still remains quite not sure. This is a quite recent paper from the group of Zdena Palkova from Czech Republic, and they are for a long time very interested in how the yeast colony, in development of yeast colony. So here you can see the model that they propose. So this is, and what's important, this is all for feral yeast, so which are quite different from the laboratory yeast. So this is how the colony look like after 24 hours, when already they could distinguish cells on the bottom, which do adhere to the agar, which they form a pseudo hyphae, and on the upper sides of the colony you could see the cells which are in stationary phase, so it means they are not dividing anymore, and cells which are still divided. But after 7 days, there's another type of cells which could be found in the colony. This is a type of the cells that are non-dividing, however retaining viability. Those are called virgin cells, which were not budded in their lifetime. And it is claimed that this kind of cells could be a kind of G0 cells, so the cells which are very important for the regrowth of the colony. So what's also important, this EMC is for extracellular matrix. This is a kind of oligosaccharides proteins mixture which filled this space, this white space here, kind of protecting those G0 cells from the stress. So that's how it looks in a more colorful way. So you can see the green dots are the dividing, then you can see the early stationary phase and stationary phase, and then after 3-4 days, you can see this blue cells, which are the one which has no division activity, either retained viability, very important. So, what do we know about the molecular base of this colony organization? We know that it's in all of this kind of organizations, the floculins are responsible. And up till now, there are 9 of them identified. It's flo 1, flo 5, 9, 10, and 11, and agar 1. And they are responsible for different actions in the colony. First of all, they are responsible for the aggregation between the cells. So the cells which do express floculins, they aggregate. They mediate the binding to the foreign surface. Those are mainly flo 10 and flo 11. they produce, they are responsible for production of this extracellular matrix, and is unnecessary for pseudo-IV. It is known that these close connected groups are protected from all these stresses, so from freezing, throwing, hot chemical attacks, and so on. So, then, of course, we can ask why not all of them found around stress globulins, and what are the causes of such protection? The cause is that just expressing globulins made the strains go slower, about a quarter. In case of flow one, it's about a quarter. So now we are coming to the story, which already have been told here. if such a cooperation exists here, how does it happen that it's not turned out by the cheaters, huh? By the cheaters or by the individuals who would profit the protection, however, without lowering the fitness by the production of globulins. And again, we're coming back to the ideas of William Hamilton and later on Richard Dawkins. It's the idea that the cooperating individuals identify themselves by a conspicuous phenotype, so by something which is easily visible. So why it is called green beard. But except from coding this phenotype, this gene should be pleiotropic, so it should code for the other feature. And so any cooperative traits. And what is important also that behavior, that green beard behavior, should be irrespective of the genetic relatedness. So, because of all these discussions here, I yesterday again opened this article and tried to look on this, and maybe now I will understand what's wrong with it. But okay, let me start. So this is the article that flow one is a variable green beard gene that drives cooperation. So why? Okay, so it is said that that's what I just said before, that Hamilton presumed that it might be a presence of a single gene that drives the tendency to cooperate towards the other towards the other carrier of such a gene. So let's take a closer look at this. What the smuggler did in this experiment. So he, as I told you before, the laboratory strain, they do not express globulin. So he make the laboratory strain express one gene, flow one, and this was enough to make them sticky, yes, to make them happily glued to each other. As you see, they are quite much more happy when both expressing cells can adhere. They are less sticky when there is one of them only expressing, and there is no adherence when none of them expressing properly. So he mixed the population in equal measure and let it grow for like 20 hours. And what he found out that after this was done in mixture in liquid, so they could easily migrate, and the population was homogeneous. So you could see that almost all of the flocculating cells were made the flocks. And what was more also very interesting, some of the cells which do not flocculate, which entered the flocks, they were just by their physical, mechanistical forces, they were just pushed up and ended up as the very first line of defense, so not very good place to be in the colony. To be sure that it's just one gene and that it's not a kin selection which is involved in such a phenomenon, he expressed the flow one in the Saccharomyces paradoxus. This is another species of Saccharomyces. However, the flow one is a completely absent gene and never found in paradoxus. And he found a similar pattern. So after this time of let them grow, he found that most of the strain which do express loculins, they were in the flocks. So to sum this up, I think that most of the conditions which are important for the green finch is fulfilled here. So we have the conspicuous phenotype, kind of, that's a self-service protein which is encoded by the FLO1 gene. We do have a pleiotropic effect. It's a growth rate. So we do have a recognition, however, without personalizing it, as we said, it's just strictly chemical mechanistic recognition. There are benefits of being in the flocks. It was shown that the cells which were in the flocks, they were more resistant to chemical stress, they have twofold greater survival for ethanol treatment, and 100 times fold better survival for antifungal antibiotics. And there are costs connected with the expressing this protein. So under normal growth condition in the flocks, the flock rating strains grow more than 5 times slower than non-flock rating strains. So we can of course talk about this later, but I think that this could be an example of the mutual benefit. If we call it a green beard or not a green beard, however, it's still a good example of mutual benefit behavior. Another story that is connected with yeast, and it's raised in the aspect of undifferentiated multicellularity, is the invertase secretion. And so yeast can, produce different enzymes. One of them is invertase. Invertase is a SAC2 gene, and what it does, it breaks the sucrose into the glucose and fructose. However, instead of taking it immediately to the cell inside the cell, it does excrete it to the environment. So we need other hexose transporters in the cell wall, which do transport them into the cell. So, of course, so like this, you can treat this glucose and fructose, which are in the environment, as a produced public good. Invertase producers, they do incur a fitness cost, and you can imagine the arising of the cheaters who will use the public goods without its production and will argue with the producer. So here are the first paper about this from 2004, which showed that the success of the factor of the cheaters, of course, depended on the how many cells were present, how much of the public goods is already produced. It is quite simple and I guess easy to understand that it was shown that lab yeast cell could not grow from a single cell in the low concentration of glucose. There were needed a clump of cells which do produce the sucrose to raise the population. So, and it's also very typical for all feralist Saccharomyces cerevisiae that they grow as a clump, that they do not, after mitosis, they do not separate completely. And there was a quite recent paper from Kushbanet that he introduced some others, some other aspects in this system, and he showed that in the lower concentration of this public good, success of the producers of SAC2 genes depends on a close contact with other cells, and it's promoted by the structure environment and by cell clumps. So quite easy to follow, I guess. And his data suggested that the use of this secreted products can indeed lead to natural selection for incomplete cell separation. And in the next step, he hypothesized that it can be an origin of multicellular life. So this would be a second example. Okay, and now we go to the third story, so we are quite in the middle of the story. It's about the toxin production, so-called killer phenotype. So yeast, as many other microorganisms, can produce toxins. It's known for more than 35% of E. coli strains, but it's also observed in several different organisms like ciliate sponges. And it is shown that 5 to 30% of yeast strains observed in the nature are toxin producers. However, though this is still there's not much data about it. So how does it work? Contrary to bacteriocins, so the bacterial toxins, the producer are. They do not commit suicide, so they are resistant. So the strains, they do produce toxin, and they are not killed by it. So here on the you can see how it's visible on the petri dish, on the agar. So this is a colony of the killer, which produced the toxin, which makes the kind of a halo. So it kills and lyses the cells of the sensitive strains. This is just a sensitive strain. And here is the opposite situation. So this is a lone of the killer strain, and the blue is means that the dead cells of the sensitive strain. These toxins, those are the small proteins, so they kill cells of the same or unrelated species. They don't demand direct contact of the cells. And what's very important for making experiments with it, they are very fragile, and they operate at a given temperature, strictly and pH. So they are very, very fragile. And this toxin production could be treated as example of interference competition. So usually we meet resource competition when the organism fights over resources. So interference competition involves the active fighting also to kill or to just somehow get rid of the competitive organisms. And what's maybe also interesting that it's the genetic base of this toxicity. So this killer phenotype, there are two different kind of viruses inside the cell. One of them is the responsible for production of the toxin. This is a kind of it's an M virus, and it's double-stranded RNA virus. And the second one, it's LA virus. It's responsible for the presence and stability of the previous virus, of the M virus. And there are a lot of different types of toxins. However, those three, K1, K2, and K28, are the most famous, and they're most experiments are done on them. So as you see in this killer phenotype, it's not only yeast, but it's again another player involved. And this is the situation what Magda, she's here on the, of course, you know her. She's doing her PhD on the system, so she's interested in the coevolution of this yeast and virus system. Can the system be altered? And if we and she's investigating the coevolution of the sensitive and killer strains, how they do it and what based. And she's also examining the diversity of the white killers. So in our lab we have a quite big collection of the white strains. So she's trying to find out what kind of viruses they have inside. So again, production of the toxin is costly, like you might presume already. So it's about 3% the killer toxin strain. They grow about 3% less fast than the sensitive strains. And this was kind of the pilot experiment done, which to see what frequencies of the strains would allow them for longer term coexistence together. So you could obviously see that in the structured environment, so there was just on the plates, no matter from what initial frequency you started, the killer phenotype can always increase in size. However, in the non-structured environment, there was a threshold beneath which the killer could not dominate the population. So success of the killer is dependent on the environment structure and on the initial density. So this was later used in the kind of long-term evolutionary experiment, which in case of yeast lasts for 400 generations. Again, this was in the environment when the nutrients were available, and the difference was there was no dispersal and dispersal involved. Again, you can see that there's a specific threshold for that just allowed for killer to persist, however, do not dominate the population. And this is what you see well on the beginning. So this is how it was observed on the plate. After 14th transfer, which is like about 20, 30 days, we could already see the colonies of the killers were just increasing with every transfer.
Could you explain what should we see with the
girl? Okay. Okay. So because the Jacques said it's a moon. It's like anyway. It's not a moon. It's a petri dish. Okay. This is a petri dish, and the thing what you see is just a second. How it was done. So this was on the structured environment, so I let the population grow, and then I transferred it using velvets. It's just replica plating to another plate. So when you transfer about 1/10% of the population, and then let it grow again. So without disturbing the structure. Yes? So this is what you see here. Stop it somehow. Or maybe it could better to do like this. So after 14th day of transfer, you could see the groups of the killer, which makes a small halo around it, and they just growing with every transfer. Can you see? Yeah. So it is. I just found it nice. That's why I.
Halo is the boundary of the killer.
Yeah, halo is because the. This killer K1, they work. They just make the sensitive strain dilute. So that's why I made the halo around. Okay. So this what we could see in the graphs, we could also see on the plates. They're just growing in size. So now we know that production of killers pays off for the killer in the structure environment by the enhanced effect of the undiluted toxin, killing the closest resources competition. And there was also a hypothesis that this can release the nutrients from the dead cells nearby and use it, profit from this. So that's why we also planned the experiment on the condition where the nutrients were not available, and that you can see here that it lasts the same for 80 days, 80 transfers. But you could see this is the K, the number of K to S. So you could see it does not increase. It just that being at the same state all the time. So it seems that the benefit of toxin killing is only profits only when the nutrients are abundant. So and when the dispersal is limited. So now I hope I convinced you a little bit that killer phenotype can be used as an example of selfishness. So when the cells which produce toxin, they do have positive effects, while the recipient is, of course...
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
You said that the toxin production is more and the nutrients are more. So why does the cell need to kill another cell with toxin when the nutrients are already available? What is the
Can you repeat the question, please?
The question was, when the resources are available, why do we need an extra weapon? Eh? Why do we need toxin to have it more? I think they're optimizing it. I mean, they would like to have the more benefit they can.
Will it work under natural selection? Will it be relevant?
The question is this relevant in nature?
I mean, is it happened in nature? Yeah, it's like I said on the beginning. It's they said that 5 to 30% of the strains they do express that they do have the viruses inside. However, nothing is known about the killing in the nature. And this kind of experiment is quite difficult to do.
Yes, we can discuss later.
Then the last story, and I would like to mention it's the presence of the program cell death in the unicellular organism. It's a quite controversial subject. There's not much known about it. However, there are more and more papers which showing that this phenomena is present in the unicellular organism and also in the yeast. So, program cell death has been discovered into multicellular context, while the cell level is not an individual level. And it's the program cell death means that some cells are destined to die, that some cells die in the following genetically encoded program, or however you call it, anyway, sequence of actions. This process needs energy, involves changes in gene expression, and can be blocked till the point of no return, so-called, after which passing which cell is just dead. So, however, if we think about a unicellular organism, we should remember that the cell level is not is an individual level. So it's difficult to still to say that some cells are destined to die. All the story with yeast apoptosis began in 1997 with the discovery of the cell division cycle mutant in gene CDC48, which shows typical marker of apoptosis. And now there are 19 genes. If you go to SGD, Saccharomyces genome database, you can find 19 genes which are associated with yeast apoptosis. The most known are mammalian caspase gene, apoptosis inducing factor, and mitochondrial nuclease. So what were these markers observed? Of course, reduced survival, but this tells not much about the way how they die. All these markers which are used here, they were originated for the eukaryotic cells, so they are just used for yeast cells and with good results. People observed loss of cell membrane integrity, which you can use propidium iodide staining. One of the features is also phosphatidylserine exposure, nuclear fragmentation, chromatin condensation, and some other biochemical features, where the most important is activation of caspase. Still, there was a lot of discussion about the caspase in yeast. Is it the same caspase as in higher eukaryotes? However, biochemical and molecular data confirm the existence of programmed cell death in yeast, confirm the presence of the cells which die, showing certain apoptotic markers. So the question arises, why they die? Can dying could be a better strategy than living? And when and why? And who is beneficial of such death? Very soon, there were a quite increasing number of papers which shows different scenarios of explaining why cells should die or die. For example, one is an example of the killer yeast. So the high concentration of killer toxin just make the cell lies. However, low concentration of the toxin make the cells apoptotic, of sensitive cells. Very commonly observed apoptotic death was during the aging. Was it the chronological aging or replicative aging? Chronological aging, it's just the way that the population is starved and just let it stay in certain environment for days. While replicative aging, it's the number of replication each cell can do. So they observed that the age, the old cells very more often go through apoptosis. It was also observed in the colony differentiation. So the cells which were quite old in the middle of the colony died via apoptosis. Again, this was all done for laboratory strains. Cells which could not mate because of different reasons, when they failed to mate, they go through apoptosis. So there are all different ways, different scenarios why it was observed. And it was explained, of course, by the benefits it brings to the population. So there is a spare of nutrients, the removal of weak, unhealthy, sterile cells, and following protection of better cells, and that it facilitates adaptation to new or changing environments. So again, from evolutionary perspective, if you think about this, we could think, could the program, could such a death benefit on the another level of organization without being adaptive on the level that it's really happening? And when death of the individual, extreme altruism, could be an adaptation. So I know that you already are prepared for all of this because of the explaining in selection by previous speakers. So all these papers had implicit assumption that this active cell death is an adaptive trait which has evolved and it's maintained through kin selection. So it's assumed that the population, while it is happening in the population, that the population is highly related. Again, what are the conditions for kin selection to evolve? That's the same Hamilton's rules once again. So the increase of the fitness measured as a self-gene copy number transferred to the next generation should be bigger than the cost. In this case, it's a very high cost, it's the death of the individual. So, and again, another condition is that the relatedness between the actor and the recipient should be higher than the relatedness between the actor and the random member of the population. And the experiments which are done on this topic do not really worry about this to fulfill those conditions or to check to have a control for those conditions. We can easily, I think we can imagine the experiments which can control for this. For it could be difficult. There are not much data about how to control for kin recognition discrimination in mice. However, we can easily control the genetic structure or and the environment structure. Another set of data which try to explain the presence of apoptosis. Those are the experiments with mutants of the genes responsible for apoptosis, for example, yeast, caspase, or glutaradoxin. So when the researcher used such strains, they got the results. So they got the result, which was the population decreased in fitness or increased the mutation rate. And the conclusion that they drawn was that the active cell death removed damaged cells. So it works for a benefit of the population. However, they did not check for the pleiotropic effects. So is the metacaspase loss has an effect on individual fitness? It could have the higher contact of the oxidized proteins or just higher mutation rate. And so there is another hypothesis which try to explain the presence of the apoptosis, not in the respect of costs and benefits or any evolutionary program, but just as the byproduct of metabolism, that it can be just the effect that it represents the inability to suppress the mitochondria's production of reactive oxygen species, the so-called oxidative burst. If it's happened, it would be maladaptive, so it would be difficult to explain how it's maintained. However, still, it could be possible that this genes has other effect pro-survival function on the earlier stage of life or for yeast. So, especially knowing that, for example, having a higher number of mitochondria very often results in a higher growth rate, which could be really beneficial for the beginning. And then it can make the cell die via apoptosis. So So this is that's another hypothesis which should not be ruled out, which should be remembered. And so that's the last story. So I don't know if we can. I'm not convinced. I mean, I'd rather not convinced that we can treat it as an altruism, as an example of really extreme altruism. Maybe in a certain cases when we know about the condition of the population. To sum up all I've said, I would like to say that the yeast is a very well-defined modern organism. And there are thousands of laboratories which use it in, all over the world in different aspects. And taking into account that there is the rapid progress in this microbial social biology, and there's a good framework for evolutionary research, we can think about that there are a lot of open, intriguing questions to answer. So we can imagine, we can plan a very nice experiments, set up the conditions which could give us some answer. However, we have to remember that such experiments never will give us the full picture of what is going on in the nature. Okay, with this I would like to finish, and this is my acknowledgement for the people I work in, Professor Rashad Korona, with whom I work at the Jagiellonian University, Ariane de Visser, where in Wageningen University when I done the work with the killer yeast, and members of the group I work. I would like to mention also my sponsors. This is could be important information for the students who would like to maybe join our institute for the PhD. That's a SET program, Science, Society, Environment, Technology, that sponsor some PhD grants and also some postdoc grants. It's not only in the Institute of Environmental Science, but it's more, there are different departments involved. So if you are interested, please come to look at this webpage. Thank you very much.
I have a question and a comment. The first is on your first story, the sucrate, secreted sucrate. Why secrete at all when you can make the sugar from inside and then use it, have the enzyme inside the cell rather than secrete it outside? Why would natural selection favor such a model? Second one.
Let's go step by step. So the first question is, why is sucrase secreted?
After the environment. Shall I answer? Shall not?
Sure.
I don't know. I
second
mean,
it's a comment.
It's the thing is that sucrose, it's not very often a meat a source of a carbon in nature. So it's kind of it's not the main pathway for energy, I would say.
All the more contradictory to make an enzyme. Secreted towards a substrate that is very rarely available.
Why does the cell make an enzyme and release it when the substrate is rare?
I think I can ask you the same question. I mean, because it's just what is observed. I mean, why they do it? I don't know.
So the second is more of a comment. Is it easy to imagine that we are dealing with an intrinsically multicellular organism where you see the unicellular phase, one small portion of its life cycle? That would just treat yeast as a typical multicellular organism.
Can we treat yeast as a typical multicellular organism?
Right.
I would doubt. If you take into account that how they live in nature,
yeah.
they go through the cycles of kind of feast and famine. So even that for a happy time they can live as a multicellular colony, it's not for a long time, and they have to be prepared and adapted to the to go through the bottleneck stage where they probably have to go through single cell or bio spores, which are. So I wouldn't treat yeast as a typical multicellular organism.
Many microbiologists are reconfiguring even bacteria, whether they are really unicellular, because in natural habitat you find mostly biofilms, which are multicellular colonies.
Yeah, but if you consider, okay, if you consider multicellular organism, it's not that, I mean, most of the, I think if we take into account how much time the yeast nature spent as a single cell comparing to the time that they spent as a multicellular colony, it's much much more often that they are in the starving single cell, I would say.
Sylvia?
I have two questions. The first one is, do I understand right that you are suggesting that what is usually interpreted as altruistic behavior in a given context might be simply selfish behavior in another context? Like, for instance, if you have a population that is fermenting and then mitochondria basically are inactivated, then in this case it could be better for the cells not to have to spend energy to deal with rust.
Once again, you said...
Is altruistic behavior in one context the same as selfish behavior in a different context?
I'm referring to your last example,
mm-hmm.
Apoptosis. So you said if you interpret apoptosis as the lack of control of rust produced during respiration, then you may think that in fermentation this is something that is advantageous for the single cell.
Yeah, I think it's very often depend how you plan the experiment and control about it. And I think it can be like this. So it's certain, the same behavior can be understood in different way, which is not so good for the sake of experiments.
And I have a second question about the toxins. So I do not really. I think that if you had to compare the structured and unstructured environment, basically you should do it in a way that the concentration of toxins, the local concentration of toxins, should be the same in the two, if you want to compare to these models, because these models rely on the fact that your effect on the other is the same. But if the effect is mediated by the concentration of the toxins, then it could not be a surprise that in a mixed environment where you lower the concentration of the toxin, you have that toxin producers lose.
The thing is, I didn't said it, but in this experiment that we show the data, in this experiment, the condition where the dispersal were present, where the cells were growing on the plates, and then during transfers they were just washed from the plates. So it was not mixed population in the liquid. So that's why the concentration of toxin was the same as in the structure. So
in both cases, you had
on
the basic plate. Sorry,
yeah,
okay,
I didn't say.
Just a comment on what Mari was just saying.
Just a comment on what Mari was just saying, that the bacteria may be considered as multicellular due to the biofilm formation. My knowledge says that multicellularity is based on the diverse cell types you have in each cell type, so contributing to a specific function, be it a form of a tissue or whatever. Biofilm formation or population is more like social behavior when they come together, they're not contributing to those cells. It's a function.
So the point seems to be, maybe you could take it up later, that in biofilms you have division of labor. And so that is okay. Any other questions?
Yeah. What do they call recognition in this article? Because what you said is that actually flow 1 binds oligosaccharides. So,
well, it was flow 1 in the yeast. They spoke about recognition because they needed to have the conditions for the three conditions for the green biology. But why do they speak of recognition? Since it's simply a protein that recognizes oligosaccharides. So how would the cells that bear this green bird recognize other cells that bear the same green bird, whereas the protein just binds oligosaccharides that all the cells bear?
I think you're referring to this, that there is no specific movements out of, for example, the white set. I think it's just random, yeah? They just meet by random.
Yes. So why do they say that there is a specific, that they recognize other cells that have the same specific trait? I think
I think it's just a kind, I mean, whatever we call it, it's the important is to whom we give our, to whom we give the for whom we lowered our fitness, yes, for whom, that's point, yes. If we lower our fitness, we should be.
My question is more precise. It's really.
Sorry, I think the question has to do with what you mean by recognition.
Yes, it's exactly that. What? Not you. It is there. They mean by recognition.
So they mean by recognition just random, not random, but cells which do adhere much more when they both express flavorins. And you know that, yes?
This is just efficiency of binding. If you have half of the protein to bind, it's obvious that you bind less efficiently than if you have.
Yes, that's what they. That's what
so
they
this
call
is recognition. You just, if you have mutant and you just have half of the protein to bind.
Yeah, but
there's efficient. I mean, they are just making sentences around observations that needs to say.
Yeah, no, I think the point Jacques is making is this a quantitative trait or a qualitative trait? Is that putting it correctly?
Yeah, no, it's about the way to use these terms of the literature, the sociobiological literature, to qualify observations that are very simple to qualify if you just use a molecular mechanisms description, you see? There is binding protein, it is on the membrane. If both cells have the protein, they bind well. If only one cell has the protein, there is still binding because the flow plus is able to bind the oligosaccharide to flow minus, but since the flow minus does not bind the flow plus, binding is less efficient. So we publish in Nucleotides Research, but you are doing science. If you say that there is a green bird, you're not doing science anymore. You're doing a crystal story.
I think that is the point of
money. No, I'm sorry, because can you tell me any case of recognition that is immune to this thing? If I say facial recognition, you say, oh, that's just the firing of a neuron in response to a certain visual stimulus. And that's the end of it. If the visual stimulus is better, then I fire more. If it's worse, I fire less. So in every single case, what you call recognition is sort of at a higher level of description. I mean, it's an implementation. Tell me one example of recognition that is immune to your particular criticism. I would like, what I think the idea would be that if you have different flow protein, so if you have a population,
I think
this case where you have a, sorry.
You said you have recognition.
See, no. We speak about that. No, green bird specifically that. It is that the individuals who bear the gene are able to specifically recognize the other individuals who bear the gene. This is exactly the condition that Dawkins put in
here. Specificity is quantitative.
No, I will tell you the counter example. So, I think that when you have mutant, there is, of course, someone who is blind is not able to recognize anymore. Okay. Then there is not much to say. The question would be, you would convince me of specific recognition if you find examples, and you probably can find them, and in this case, recognition, irrespective of the anthropomorphic way of expressing it. What I would call recognition is the fact that inside a population, there are some there is some polymorphism of the for the transmembrane protein, binding protein, okay? And that this polymorphism is such that if you have allele A, the individuals with allele A will bind better with individuals having allele A than with individuals having allele B. This is specific recognition. No, no, this is not what they show. What they show is that when you have allele A which has the protein, then you bind better.
So what's the difference between having two alleles
or having one allele and one the other? No. The big difference is that I also want for individuals having allele B to bind better for individuals having allele B.
What?
And here the mutant they will just not bind.
You don't need mathematical. Sorry? You're setting facts which don't need mathematical. The only point is that I have a source among the ones who are similar to me.
They do not so.
Especially that there are much more flow proteins present. This is just one example, but this is a lot of variety in this gene. So it might be that one is expressing one type of flow and the other type that's on this base you can recognize. It's also present. It's not shown in experiment, but it's mentioned in the paper.
You mean it has been shown in other papers?
No, in this paper it's shown that the flow one has a different variance, and it could be different cell types can express different flow. So they can also, the strength of their binding is also different, so that's a kind of a recognition.
Did they show differential binding?
They don't show, not in the paper. No, it's not shown. It's not shown, but I guess it could be shown.
I think,
right,
in
the
stadium, it's too solid.
Beg your pardon?
It's too solid. In the stadium, you had that.
Well, look, you have homophilic addition molecules. Now, whether you want to call the addition mediated by these molecules recognition or not, up to you. Yeah, I know.
Actually, to add on to the same conclusion, is it possible that you make a column of these with flock, which express flock, then pass through them the binding type, the ones that don't express? Would you see addition? Because in your experiment, they were free floating. And in free floating, you can have instances where no plus can actually gather around no minus. But if you have a column where one is adhered and the other is passed through this column, such an experiment be possible, and can that distinguish between the different phenomena? I look at it more as an antigen antibody recognition mechanism.
I guess it's possible, but instead of such a random mixing, you would prefer that it stick to the column and then it's bind. Yes, I can imagine such things.
Okay, thanks. But before breaking up, a couple of things. One is to correct a mistake I made in the morning. We leave for